Okay, then the title of the talk is Slums and Slumps, Housing Under Capitalism. It's a talk I did at head office last month where all the rough edges were removed and so on. I want to begin by taking you back to 1942, the publication of the Beveridge Report, which was essentially the foundation of the post-war welfare state. The Beveridge Report identified what it called five giant evils, which it should be the aim of social policy to do away with. The five giants were want, disease, ignorance, idleness, and squalor. And squalor meant housing, but also sort of town planning and the general environment as well, not just housing. The Beveridge Report was tremendously popular at the time. It sold out very quickly. And for example, newspapers in Nazi Germany were forbidden from mentioning the Beveridge Report on the grounds it would be a tremendous sort of propaganda coup for the enemy, i.e. British capitalism. If you can see this is the front page of the Daily Mirror the day the Beveridge Report was published. You can see the headline, Banish Want, and the famous phrase, Cradle to Grave, the Cradle to Grave plan, it calls it. 1942, so there's also stuff on that page about the course of the war. There's also an advert for OXO, so you know, some things never change. Part of the aim of the Beveridge Report was not so much to remove want and disease and so on, but to simplify the whole welfare system, to simplify the whole payment system and the ways in which things were paid out. So again, one of the headlines here, all pay, all benefit, supposedly. Although squalor was one of the giants that the Beveridge Report identified, there wasn't in fact very much in the Beveridge Report specifically on housing. Although what there was is, I think, fairly instructive. They proposed a flat rate benefit, but that was very much at a subsistence level, and if you'd got this, you couldn't afford to buy a pint of beer or even a half or newspapers, because that simply wasn't part of what the sort of spending envisaged. But if you've got this subsistence level, one of the problems with it from the government and the ruling classes' point of view was that people who had low rents were getting, quotes, too much. And this is always one of the problems with some capitalist reforms, that sometimes, quote, too much is paid out to people who, for one reason or another, are not perhaps quite as badly off as some other people are. I began by talking about the Beveridge Report and poverty in general, because I think it's important to see that housing is something that has to be seen as part of the wider social situation and social problems, not something that you can look at in isolation. And what I want to do in this talk is to look at various aspects of housing and developments, not so much since 1942, but sort of developments over a period over the last few years and so on, and look at the ways in which capitalism does or does not address and solve the housing problem, and to see that to the extent to which, although things change, really the housing problem continues and is really an inevitable part of capitalism. The Beveridge Report, as I said, appeared in 1942. On the 50th anniversary of it, the academic Ben Pimlott wrote an article in the Guardian, in the Independent, so on the 50th anniversary of the Beveridge Report, where he made it quite clear, and Pimlott is not a socialist by any stretch of the imagination, that want and squalor still existed despite 50 years of social reform. And that in central London, for example, there were plenty of beggars and homeless people and so on. And he went on to say, for the majority, there is less hunger and disease than in the 40s. But for the millions in the minority, there is much more. So not only had all these reforms and Labour governments and so on failed to remove want and disease, but for many people, things had indeed got even worse. And one point to make in this talk is that the housing problem, as I've already suggested, changes over time, but the problem remains. So there's not quite the overcrowding, the insanitary slums of the 1930s. So, for example, among many figures, and we'll try not to give too many figures, but we'll give some. In Scotland in the 1930s, over one person in three lived more than two to a room, and sometimes far more than that. That kind of overcrowding and insanitary situation, it's not quite like that anymore. I'm not saying nowhere is like that, but for the vast majority of people, it's not quite like that. But there are still problems, as we're going to see. Now, I said that the Beveridge Report didn't really say a great deal about housing, but it certainly was not the first piece of legislation which did address housing problems. Probably the first one in Britain was 1868, the Citizens and Labourers Dwelling Act. And what that did is that it made it possible for local authorities to demolish slums in their areas, but it didn't say anything about rehousing the people who lived in the slums or about building new houses. So what it led to, in fact, was increased shortages of housing and overcrowding, and so it benefited the landlords who were able to put up rents and get even more money from the slums and so on. And as Frederick Engels pointed out, all that really happened was that the slums were shifted by that piece of legislation from one area to another, that some of the old slums were knocked down, but new slums arose because they became overcrowded in the way they perhaps had not been before. And since 1868, what's that? Not quite 150 years, but getting on that way, there's been more housing acts than you could shake a stick at. Just to take one example, the Housing Subsidy Act of 1956 gave local councils bigger subsidies from the government depending on how high the tower blocks they built were. So as long as there was a lift, they could build higher and higher, and the more government subsidy they would get for the building. The thinking behind this is that if you have tower blocks, then you can supposedly at least house more people in a particular area, and also building a tower block is, in principle at least, cheaper than building lots of separate houses or lots of low-rise buildings and so on. However, there were problems with this method of subsidy. So, for example, in May 1968, there was a large accident where a building, a tower block built by using precast concrete panels, collapsed, leading to the death of four people. Anybody know what I'm talking about?
Ronan Point.
Yeah, very good, Ronan Point. Yeah. Everybody at head office knew as well. I thought I'd catch you all out, but not. Yeah. So Ronan Point, which collapsed. It was built using large precast concrete panels, and one quote advantage of that was that skilled construction workers weren't needed to do the assembly and the putting together, so clearly it was cheaper to do it that way. And what happened was that there was a gas explosion and panels blew out. What happened was that there was a gas explosion and the panels blew out and the corner of Ronan Point collapsed, and I said four people died. And it turned out that the method that had been used for this block, it was okay, but it was specifically intended to be used for buildings which had a maximum of six stories, and Ronan Point had 22, so way, way over the allowed maximum, and, well, not exactly an accident waiting to happen, but if anything did happen, there was pretty much bound to be a disaster in that kind of situation. And that's just an example of the kind of way in which governments, councils, etc. do save money, but often at the...
Hello.
You're good friends, are you?
I hope so.
Yeah. In which local councils do save money, but at the cost of health and safety. And if we come on more recently to look at the ways in which housing has changed and prices have gone up and so on. Again, some figures here. Between 1959 and 2009, real earnings on average rose by 169%, but house prices rose by 270%. So the cost of housing has risen by much more than average wages have gone up. So on the whole then, houses are far less affordable now than they were 50 years ago. And over a shorter time span, in 1997, the average house price was 3.7 times the median wage, and 2009 it was 6.5 times the median wage. So there's been a really quite striking increase in house prices, not just in monetary terms, but in comparison to prices in general and to wages in particular. So while the quality of housing has no doubt, for the most part, gone up in that time, but houses are less affordable than they used to be. And far more people rely now on that well-known banking institution, the Bank of Mum and Dad, to get a start on the housing ladder, to borrow the deposit for their first mortgage, and so on, and so on. And many people are put off starting a family, or sorry, people do put off starting a family because of fears about the rent and the mortgage and so on. And just to illustrate the ways in which the media spin this, here's a thing from the my local paper in South Manchester just a few months ago. Rentals on the rise as mortgages out of reach, that far more people are renting because they can't afford to buy. But I want to draw your attention in particular to the subheading here. More people than ever before are choosing to rent rather than buy. It's that word choosing which you should reflect on. People in that situation are not choosing to rent rather than to buy. They're being forced to rent rather than buy because they simply cannot afford to buy their own house and so on. Coming up to the sort of the current situation again, there are lots of figures we could give. In 2004, for example, there were in Britain over 1 million children in poor housing. I know you might argue what counts as poor housing, but some sort of figure like that is entirely reasonable, I think. And repossessions, which used not to be a big problem, but did become a big problem in the 90s, was before that. Having a house repossessed was not really a big threat to most people, but it's now creeping up again, the number of repossessions having been much lower sort of up until a few years ago. And in the United States, for example, in April alone, there were 92,000 repossessions. I think they call them foreclosures in the States, but there were 92,000 repossessions in April. And in Las Vegas, one home in 60 had got a repossession notice, which is quite a staggering figure if you think about it. One in 60 has had a repossession notice in recent years and so on. And behind each of those examples and each of those figures in the thousands is a human tragedy of some degree or another, of perhaps of homelessness or of much poorer housing conditions. Or to take another example, rent to buy, buy to rent landlords. Some of them have been turfing tenants out of their homes because they can't afford to pay the mortgage anymore. So they've been turfing the tenants out just by going then changing the locks and locking the tenants out. And while that's illegal, it happens, and many tenants don't really have the guts to complain about it. So there are far for many people who are made homeless, whether by repossession or whatever, there are far their sort of housing situation inevitably deteriorates and so on. There's been a recent, in fact, was it today or yesterday? What's the 24th? When was that? Saturday. Yeah. So I've got a cutting here from a couple of days ago that the heading UK's poorest are to lose £600 a year in housing benefit cuts. So with the current government cutting spending and so on, quite likely they will be losing great deal of money in terms of housing benefit. And another thing in today's Metro, with the heading, poor families may never find a home. And if the government slashes budgets and so on, then it will be extremely difficult for the very poorest in society to afford a home, because there simply aren't, for example, enough council houses being built or available. So, for example, this figure says they will leave another 500,000 on housing waiting lists and so on, and the government is boasting about building 9,000 new social homes, which is barely even a drop in the ocean compared to what is needed. Now, in some examples, in some cases, housing problems can lead to absolute desperation on the part of those who suffer from them. And I've got a couple of extreme examples here. They are extreme examples, as I said, and I don't suppose this sort of thing happens very often, but I think probably many people are led to this degree of desperation but don't quite take the final step, of a man whose mortgage debts led to him setting the house on fire so that the bank wouldn't get it. And that was in 1990, and 1982, a man who set fire to the house where he and his family lived desperately as a way to get rehoused, the only way he thought he could get rehoused. Of course, capitalism did provide him with some alternative accommodation for 18 months. Now, in 2000, the Labour government, you remember the Labour government? Before the current one, yeah? They launched a decent homes programme intended to upgrade social housing, due to end this year. But they decided that, in fact, it would take till 2018 to complete to meet the targets for that. So they've clearly not gone anywhere near the targets and bridges for that. And the amount of local council housing that's built is going down and down and down. And from one figure I had, in the first quarter of this year, can you guess how many new local authority houses or homes were completed in the first quarter of this year? Anybody guess?
25.
You're taking the piss. It's a bit more than that, but not much.
125.
60 is the answer. Really, so 25 is the right order of magnitude. It's not quite the answer.
There's at least six new ones going up in Manchester.
At least six.
Yeah.
That's another 50 somewhere else.
It's a big count.
That's Manchester, City of Manchester, you mean?
Yeah.
The life of council estates gets shorter and shorter. So I didn't realise this until I had a note through my door a few weeks back. A lot of the homeless people are ex-service people who have been, quote, defending their country in Iraq or Afghanistan. And when they get back here, they are often dumped on the streets, well, not quite literally, but very nearly so. And capitalism doesn't really care very much about what happens to them. They often have various mental health problems as well, but they have housing problems too. According to one textbook on housing, the building industry exists to meet human needs. Unfortunately, that's completely wrong. The building industry exists to make profits. Bovis Homes have now started paying dividends again after stopping for a year. You'll be pleased to hear about that. Of course, for some people, there is no housing problem other than finding somewhere which fits in with their lifestyle. Thank you, yeah. So I've got one here. Far East buyers lead London property boom, and affluent Far Eastern buyers are piling into the London property market, attracted by the weak pound, record low interest rates, and dramatic undersupply of housing and so on. So a lot of them are buying flats for their kids to come over here and study at university, which will then be investments for when they go back to Hong Kong or Singapore or wherever. So plenty of people don't have a housing problem. But they have more than one house, some of them, I believe. In conclusion then, we've seen that the housing problem changes, but it remains the same. Houses become less affordable, even though perhaps the overall quality is improved. But I think we should realise that there isn't really a housing problem. People know how to build houses. There are people who can build houses. There are the materials to build the houses. So it's not a housing problem, it's a poverty problem. People cannot afford to buy houses, and there's no point in building houses for those who cannot afford them. And people work all hours to be able to afford houses. I don't have the figures here, but I've seen figures for how long an American worker on either on the minimum wage or on the average wage would have to work in order to afford a flat in parts of New York. They'd have to effectively work 10 hours every day for a year before they could possibly afford the rent even. And one US activist said this: there's a mismatch between where the housing is and what it costs and what people who need it can afford. It's really water everywhere and not a drop to drink. So there are empty houses and there are people who can build houses, but there are, alongside those are homeless people or people living in slums or overcrowded conditions because they simply can't afford the houses which do exist or could quite straightforwardly be built. I think the housing situation shows very clearly that capitalism can't meet people's needs in any true sense of meeting people's needs. It can't provide decent and sensible homes and housing for a vast majority of people. Let me read you just a quote from an excellent journal, no longer published, The World Socialist. Housing is probably the one basic need which, were it properly satisfied, would be the most conducive to good emotional and mental health. It is surely very pleasant and soothing to relax among pleasant and agreeable surroundings. But for far too many people, that's not something which is an achievable aim. Even if people can afford the housing, they have to work all the hours that, well, not all the hours that God made, but you know what I mean, in order to be able to afford them. Housing is built not as that textbook I quoted argues to meet human need. It's houses are built for profit, and the recent recession, and maybe we can talk about this at the end if you like, is has been caused by overkeen, borrowing, and so on. In a socialist society, the idea of people living in poor quality homes or no homes or living or sleeping on their friends' sofas, while at the same time there would be people who could build houses for them, would be completely inconceivable, because a socialist society really will be concerned with meeting people's needs rather than with building for profit. I would suggest that housing is one of the initial things that a socialist society would need to get right and to immediately solve before sort of other issues came to the fore. And maybe there are a few problems with housing in socialism, though, that while it would be perfectly straightforward to provide everyone with a decent place to live, not everybody can have the penthouse with the best view and so on. And you know, maybe you wouldn't worry about that, or maybe you'd take it in turns to live in the penthouse or something such as that. But I think issues such as that are minor and tiny compared with the extent to which socialism would solve the housing problem, because, as I said, it's not really a housing problem, it's a poverty problem, and socialism will immediately solve the problems of poverty.